Good morning. Is that working? Mauricio, is that working? Yeah. Okay. Right, Mauricio, please could you work the slides? Today we're going to look at a parable that Jesus told. And for those of you who are listening on the internet and can't see the slide, I've given it the title, Horrid Henry's Return and Perfect Peter's Meltdown. And I hope you guys are familiar with Horrid Henry. Yeah. Can anyone guess which parable I might be talking about? The prodigal son, yeah. But before we read the parable, let's look at who Jesus told the parable to. Because when Jesus taught, very often he's directing his comments at the people who were there at the time. Luke 15, verse 1. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Now, to our mind, there's maybe nothing particularly shocking going on there. But to the religious leaders and teachers who were there at the time, Jesus has just shocked them, disgusted them, horrified them. You see, the Jewish people of Jesus' day thought that good religious people should keep away from sinners. But what we see time and again throughout Jesus' ministry is that Jesus actually sought them out and ate with them, and they sought him out. And eating with someone was a covenant thing in Jesus' day. It showed that you had a relationship with the person and that you accepted the person as a brother. That really freaked out the goody-goody Pharisees. But who were these sinners? According to my commentary on Luke, they were the immoral, or those who followed occupations that the religious regarded as incompatible with the law. So the tax collectors, they routinely cheated people and they collaborated with the Roman occupying army. So they were hated, they were outcasts. And then there's these other assorted sinners that were also seen as people that a respected religious leader should avoid. And I think we often miss the intensity of the feeling that the Jewish leaders had about this subject. But actually, it has come into Jewish law. In the Talmud, which is a collection of Jewish writings and laws, which were oral traditions in Jesus' day, then written down a couple hundred years after Jesus. In the Talmud, it says, Nittai the Arbelite would say, "Keep far from an evil neighbor, do not associate with the wicked, and do not shrug off all thought of calamity." Or in another translation, Nittai the Arbelite would say, "Distance yourself from a bad neighbor, do not cling to a wicked person, and do not abandon belief in retribution." So this is a teaching that had grown up over the centuries, and the Pharisees totally believed in it. And it's since Jesus, it has now been written down as another Jewish law, on a par with the God-given laws of the Old Testament. And guess what? Jesus just smashes headlong into it. He completely refused to obey such a man-made rule, no matter how much offense it may cause the Pharisees. And that's the background to what's probably the most grace-filled chapter in all of Jesus' teachings in Luke chapter 15. I'll read verse 1 again. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So what's Jesus' reaction to that muttering, that grumbling? Well, he tells three parables which challenge the religious experts' wrong understanding of the way that God views sinners. First, there's the parable of the lost sheep. Then there's the parable of the lost coin. And then thirdly, there's the parable of the lost son, or as we often know it, the prodigal son. In the context, it's very much the lost son. It was the point that Jesus was talking about. Prodigal just means someone who spent freely, recklessly, was wastefully extravagant. So you can see how that name has come in. But in this context, it's the third of the lost parables, showing the joy when the lost is found. So, jumping to verse 11, we'll look at this parable of the lost son. Luke 15, verse 11. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them." Now, in Jewish culture, this is a shocking start to the story. So I'm going to call the younger son Horrid Henry. He was a young guy who seemed to have felt like he was in prison at home, and he wanted the freedom to live life to the max. And as the story develops, it's clear that the father loved him very deeply, but the son seems not to have felt it. And that's the heart of the story, I think. For all his machismo, Hoyt Henry felt empty inside, and he wanted the freedom to try and fill that void in any way he could. Now, he knew he couldn't do that at home. So one day, he went up to his dad and demanded his share of the family estate. Well, you don't inherit property until the person has died. So that's kind of weird. But in the culture of Jesus' day, the demand is even more shocking because, in effect, Horrid Henry is saying, "Look, Dad, I can't be bothered waiting for you to drop dead. What's taking you so long?" It's sort of maximum disrespect to the father. Now, the father could have had the son beaten for such disrespect. That's what Jesus' hearers would probably be expecting to happen next. And he certainly would not have granted the son's request. So the way Jesus tells the story, and the father lets the son have what he's asking for, all Jesus' listeners are like, "What? That would never happen. It's amazing. What's happening with this story?" Amazingly, the father let the son have what he was demanding. He gave him his share of the land, because the holdings would have been in land. And when the father did this, he's taking a big hit to his own finances, because that land is what's providing for him in his old age. Verse 13. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. So here you have the younger son going even further off the rails. because he sold the family land. Again, Jesus' listeners are thinking, well, that's incredible, that's weird, because the father would have blocked the sale. That's what they would expect. The father would just say, no, you can't sell it, it's family land. But again, the father let the son have what the son is wanting. And then the younger son left home and began living the dream, away from all the rules and this older brother. He had freedom to do whatever he wanted. And he had everything that, in our day, the glossy magazines would have us craving for. You know, he had money, possessions, popularity, the latest iPad, the new Ferrari, women, booze, the whole rock and roll lifestyle. See, loads of people dream of such things, and loads of people give their whole efforts in their life pursuing such things. But what drives us in that direction in the first place? Well, I think that the central issue is the human need to feel loved and accepted and feel like we belong when we're... When we're feeling short of love, we're not feeling accepted, we're not feeling we belong, then we try to fill that void in all sorts of ways that don't work very well. So we substitute sex for love. We substitute belongings for belonging. And we try to hide the emptiness with a double vodka. To be honest, these things that society values are as much use as filling the love void in our lives as a sticking plaster is for repairing a puncture in a car tire. You know, they may hide the problem from view, but they don't fill the tire at all. It's still flat. Anyway, in the story, the younger son lives the dream until the money runs out, and then the dream becomes a nightmare. The people he's parted with drop him, and he has no friends, no family, no one to turn to for help. And he's starving and homeless and in a really bad way. So he ends up feeding the pigs. Now, to a Jew, and Jesus was talking mostly to Jews, that is the shocking lowest of the low, because pigs were ritually unclean. And Jews were meant to have nothing to do with them, or they too would become ritually unclean. So this young man, he's at rock bottom. He's separated from his family. He's separated from his fellow Jews. And now being ritually unclean means he can't go to the synagogue or temple either. So he's seen as separated from God as well. And he's starving. It's a desperate situation. But finally, he came to his senses and realized that his only hope of survival was to go home and beg his dad for a job. Now notice, he knew that he had absolutely no chance of being accepted back as a son because of everything he'd done. He'd walked out on his father, he'd wasted the family money in sinful ways, so he knew he could never hope to be received back as a son. But he did hope that his father might hire him as a labourer, because he knew his father was a good man. That was the extent of his hope. Verse 17. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I'll set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So he got up and went to his father. So here we have the turning point in the story of the younger son. He comes to his senses, decides to return to his home village and see if the local landowner, his father, might give him a job. He assumes the relationship is short. He assumes his father will disown him. But knowing his father's character, he hopes He so desperately hopes his father might give him a job digging ditches or something. Have you ever wondered why he makes this assumption, why he assumes his father will disown him? This is a good explanation I found online. As the son comes closer to his home, he feels fear and shame. He wished his father dead, left family and community, and now he has lost everything. He expects to face his father's and brother's anger and rejection. Further, the community would reject and banish him, as was the custom. Any Jew who lost his money among foreigners would face the kezaza, literally the cutting off. The kezaza would be performed by breaking a clay pot at the feet of the prodigal as visual symbol that the community rejected him forever. You see, losing Jewish money, in this case his inheritance, amongst foreigners in such an immoral way was a very, very big deal. It was seen as unforgivable. So the people hearing Jesus tell this story would have been expecting the kezaza, the complete rejection of the young man by all the community. Can you imagine their shock at what did actually come next? Everyone listening, oh, we know where this story's going. This young lad is going to get a good thumping, probably, and he's going to be rejected. Verse 20. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. Now, a lot is made of the fact that the father saw his returning son from a long distance and so must have been watching for him. But that in itself wouldn't have shocked Jesus' listeners in the way that this shocked them. Because there's elements here that are just wacky. Everyone listening is like, what? Because they're expecting the father to reject this son. Instead, the father runs to his son. Now, in the Middle East, rich old men don't run. They wear long flowing robes, and hitching up the robe and exposing their legs and running, it just would not happen. It would be humiliating. A respected elder simply wouldn't do that. But this father did. Why? Because he loved his son, and he had to get to his son before the rest of the village beat him up or started breaking clay pots and disowning him. In other words, the father loved his son so much he was prepared to humiliate himself in order to save his son from retribution. Jesus' listeners are like blown away by this. This is freaky. Then the father kissed his son. Now, I've used the NIV translation here. Kissed is not the best translation because Luke uses an unusual word, kataphileo, instead of the more usual phileo. And kataphileo is a very strong word, more accurately translated as fervently kissed or kissed earnestly or kissed thoroughly, kissed repeatedly. It's not just a peck on the cheek. The father just grabs him and carries on hugging him and kissing him. Does anyone happen to know, or can anyone guess, the other place uses Luke uses this same word in his gospel, which was another place where it shocked the people. It's in Luke 7. I'll read from verse 36. Now one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him. So he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. When a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume. And as she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. She kissed Jesus' feet, kataphileia. She didn't just kiss them once, but fervently kissed, kissed earnestly, kissed repeatedly. No wonder Simon the Pharisee was upset. That's not meant to happen. Anyway, back to the lost son. The father called the servants to bring not just a tatty old robe, but the best robe. So it's a real honor. And he called for a ring. Many people think that could be the family signet ring, which would have been a symbol of authority to do business in the family name. And he called for shoes because free men do not go barefoot. And then the father calls for a feast to which the whole village would have been invited, because the father intends to publicly welcome his son back with a lavish and expensive community event. Nobody is going to be left in any doubt that the father accepts this son as he is. There is no retribution, no kazaza ceremony at all. And all of this would have completely shocked the people listening to Jesus. They expected an angry father who would follow the traditions by expelling the younger son. But what they got was completely undeserved forgiveness and reconciliation. And that would have been a real slap in the face for the Pharisees and teachers of the law, because it's totally the opposite of the way they thought things should be done and the way they thought God would do things. It's the total opposite of what they were teaching. But what an amazing surprise for the sinners and the tax collectors. So the younger son went home, and his father just went wild with joy and accepted him back as a full son and lavished love and acceptance on him. You know, that's an amazing picture of what grace is all about. This younger son did deserve serious punishment. He'd sinned greatly. Yet the father forgave him, and instead of punishing him, he lavished blessing on him, which the son in no way deserved. And Jesus' listeners would have been completely shocked by this, because what the younger son had done would have been seen as unforgivable. So when you have this twist in the story where the father accepts the son back unconditionally, that would have blown their minds. And that's what's so amazing about God's grace. He forgives all our sins, not just a few minor ones. And if we follow Jesus, we're no longer defined by our sin. We're defined by God's grace and the righteousness he gives us. As Paul says in Romans 3, reading from verse 22, this righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. Okay, righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There's no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. You're not defined by your past. You're not defined by your present sin if you have faith in Jesus. Everyone can be forgiven. Everyone can be righteous through through faith in Jesus, no matter what they may have done. Now, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, just could not get that. It blew their minds. They had a totally different concept of the way God would treat sinners. And I think it can be as uncomfortable to us today. We don't have the same cultural backgrounds, but I think a lot of churches have an uncomfortable relationship with certain types of sinners, maybe. And do we see some people as unforgivable, maybe? You know, if a former prisoner were to come into church, how would we receive them? If a homeless alcoholic came into church, how would we receive them? And if a gay couple came into church, how would we receive them? There's a BBC documentary that came out last year that looked at the suicide of a 14-year-old girl who was... she and her family were very involved in the church in Manchester, but she was struggling with her sexuality. She felt she was lesbian, so she took her own life. At the inquest, it was ruled that she took her own life in fear of not being accepted by her church because she was gay. Now, the vicar of the church was at the inquest, and I cannot imagine what he went through experiencing that. And as a result, he's done an awful lot of soul searching. And he's a Bible-believing Christian. He says, "I used to be someone that would hold a traditional view, but we lost a teenager at 14 to suicide. That puts everything else into perspective." And that was a terrible wake-up call to that church, that a 14-year-old who's struggling with their sexuality was so sure they would be rejected by the church family that she ended her own life. Now, I know that this is a very contentious and a complicated issue, but I do wonder if Christians have been conned by the devil into believing, or at the very least giving the appearance that sexual sin is somehow unforgivable and that the church should reject people who sin in that way. I think sometimes, because of the way the press portray these stories and portray Christian beliefs, there's a lot of lies get caught up, I think, and it can be seen that these people who are probably the most needy of Jesus expect that the church will reject them. But as I just read from Romans 3, righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There's no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. See, God sets no limits on how much he will forgive. And the death and resurrection of Jesus is powerful enough to deal with anything, absolutely anything we have done if we turn to him. Moving on, verse 25. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes come home. You kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, you're always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So now let's look at the older son, who I'll call Perfect Peter. On the outside, he looked good. He stayed at home, worked long hours on the farm, didn't party at all, just got up, worked hard, came home, had dinner, slept. No smoking, no drinking, no girls, no fast cars, no bad habits at all. But what's clear from the story is that while he looked great on the outside, he was rotten on the inside. He didn't feel loved and didn't feel like his father blessed him enough. So he went ballistic when his father showed extravagant love to the younger son who didn't deserve it. See, Perfect Peter had worked hard for that love and acceptance. How dare the father give it to this worthless other son instead? So Perfect Peter is jealous. He wanted that blessing for himself. He wanted that party for himself, not for this worthless sinner who'd done everything wrong. See, Perfect Peter felt that he deserved that blessing. He'd worked hard. Day after day, he'd worked in the fields. He deserved to be blessed. And when Jesus described this older son, he's pointing the finger firmly at the Pharisees who were in the crowd and complaining about Jesus accepting the sinners. You know, it's brilliant when people work hard for God. But there is also the danger sometimes of thinking that God owes us something when we do that. When we start thinking that way, we tend to start looking down on other people who don't work as hard as us. Oh, they're not very spiritual. They don't come to Spirit Cafe. Oh, they're not very spiritual. They're not in a life group. Oh, they go to the nightclub. They're down the pub all the time. But if we're starting thinking that way, it's so easy then to get offended when these sinful people are blessed by God. But I've earned it. I've worked hard. I deserve that blessing. How can God be blessing this other person? Such attitudes are a major problem in church and mission. I used to be a missionary. I've been a pastor in Pentecostal church. I've come across these attitudes far too many times. It's so corrosive. It's hidden away and it's sort of corroding from the inside. But these Perfect Peters, they love measuring themselves against other people to see how good they are. They sort of keep score. Why is that? Well, they're keeping the rules to try and fill the emptiness that they feel inside. It's their way of trying to cover the fact that they don't feel loved or accepted or feel that they belong. Now, God didn't give us rules for the way we should live as a way of us keeping score and comparing ourselves to other people. See, that's the way the Pharisees had twisted the Old Testament teachings. They were working hard, trying to be goody-goody, trying to do all the things and more. And Jesus was having no truck with that at all. He says, okay, you fast twice a week. The Old Testament says once a year. You're doing it twice a week. Okay, good. But what about your attitudes to the widows, the orphans, and so on? And Jesus saw straight through this attitude of trying to do things to earn blessing from God. They were just trying to fill the emptiness, trying to earn a blessing from God. And so the attitude, and you see this in other stories Jesus tells and in direct confrontations with the Pharisees, you see that they're showing off. They're praying on the street corners. When they're fasting, they're sort of looking all forlorn and that, so everyone knows they're fasting. And they're showing off. They're trying to earn honor from people. And in truth, a bottle of vodka or a rule book are equally futile ways of trying to make ourselves feel better on the inside. They're both sticking plaster solutions. A book I've used a lot over the years, written by Jack Frost, Experiencing the Father's Embrace. He asks a really difficult question to each one of us. Would you rather be right or have a relationship? See, perfect Peters just have to be right all the time, because being right is the way they try to fill the emptiness. They're not interested in the relationship. Now, in this parable, the father is right all the way through. But he's willing to lay that aside, to lay aside his rights, to lay aside the opportunity to correct his sons, in the hope of having a relationship with his two sons. We've seen how the father responded to his younger son. Now look at the reaction to his older son's behavior. He was the rich, respected older man. Yet he's being humiliated by his older son having this tanti, refusing to go in to the party. But he voluntarily humiliates himself, going outside, leaving the party to plead with his older son. He could have told the servants to haul him in, but he voluntarily went and tried to win him over. Then when the older son got even angrier, the father didn't respond with anger and calling the servants to punish the son. He carried on pleading with him and trying to win him over, trying to encourage him to come in and enjoy the party. You see, the father is totally even-handed in showing love and laying down his rights in the hope of having a relationship with both sons when both of them were in the wrong. In the end, the father regained his younger son, but then the story ends on a cliffhanger. Would the older son also accept the offer of his father's love and restore the relationship? Or would he refuse the offer? See, that's the challenge Jesus left at the end of the parable. In the crowd that Jesus was speaking to, the sinners had come to their senses and returned to God and found love and acceptance in Jesus. But the Pharisees were standing outside, angry and refusing to go in. So the challenge was, would they now accept the Father's offer, or would they remain outside? There's this even-handed offer to both. Jesus was willing to accept the Pharisees, but they had to accept him. And that offer and challenge applies to us too. If we're Horrid Henry types, will we now come to our senses and return to our loving Father who's waiting for us, longing to lavish his love on us? He longs to receive us back into his family and bless us far beyond what we deserve. But will we turn and receive? If, on the other hand, we're the perfect Peter types who haven't had a decent sin up in years, but who are slogging our guts out, trying to keep the rules, will we accept the Father's equally undeserved offer of love and forgiveness? Will we put aside our anger, our sense of hurt, our sense of I deserve, our sense of that's not fair, Will we put that aside and go into the party? Or will we refuse and stay outside? It's our choice. Today the Father is offering you an experience of his love that's far beyond anything you've earned or deserved. Will you respond to him? So today, I believe there are three reasons to come forward for prayer. Maybe you've wandered away and need to return. If so, come. The Father's waiting to welcome you with open arms. Maybe you've been slogging away serving God, but the joy's dried up and you're sort of thinking, I want love, but I'm not finding it. Come. The Father's standing at the door pleading with you to come in and join the party. Or thirdly, maybe you, like the Father, have been watching and waiting, longing for someone you love to return. Well, come forward and we'll pray with you for their return. We're going to put a song on now. If you're listening on the internet, you might prefer to go to YouTube, search for Reckless Love official live version. It's a brilliant song from Bethel, and the guy who wrote the song, they sing the song and then he explains the meaning behind it. And if you want to come forward for prayer, please do. If you want to receive in your seats, just letting it soak through you, do that. It's very, very powerful.
shadow you won't light up, mountain you won't climb up, coming after me. Yeah. There's no wall you won't kick down, lie you won't tear down, coming after me. There's no shadow you won't light up, mountain you won't climb up, coming after me. There's no wall you won't kick down, lie you won't. There's no shadow now, there's no shadow you won't light up, mountain you won't climb up, coming after me. No, 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 there's no wall you won't kick down, lie you won't tear down, coming after me. Whoa. There's no shadow you won't light up, mountain you won't climb up, coming after me. No, 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 no. This scripture to us. It's out of Luke 15. Sometimes people get confused by it, but I feel like the Lord's all over it tonight. I want to read it to us. It says, now the tax collectors and sinners are all gathering around to hear Jesus. The Pharisees and teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes the sinners and eats with them. The religious people are mad. It sets the stage and Jesus pipes up. He told them this parable. He says, suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And after he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and he goes home. He calls his friends, he calls his neighbors together and says, rejoice with me because I've found my lost sheep. And I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous people who don't. Man, he's that good. I want to just read a couple thoughts, just share a little bit of the story behind this song, and then we'll sing that bridge one more time and we'll go nuts. We'll see what happens. So when I use the phrase, the reckless love of God, when we say it, we're not saying that God himself is reckless. He's not crazy. We are, however, saying that the way he loves is in many regards quite so. But what I mean is this. He's utterly unconcerned with the consequences of his actions with regard to his own safety, comfort and well-being. His love isn't crafty or slick. It's not cunning or shrewd. In fact, all things considered, it's quite childlike. And might I even suggest sometimes downright ridiculous. His love bankrupted heaven for you, for me. His love doesn't consider himself first. It isn't selfish or self-serving. He doesn't wonder what he'll gain or lose by putting himself on the line. He simply puts himself out there on the off chance that you and I might look back at him and give him that love in return. His love leaves the 99 to find the one every time. And to many practical adults, that's a foolish concept. But what if he loses the 99 in finding the one, right? What if? Finding that one lost sheep is and will always be supremely important. His love isn't cautious. It's a love that sent his own son to die a gruesome death on a cross. There's no plan B with the love of God. He gives his heart so completely, so preposterously, that if refused, we would think it irreparably broken. Yet he gives himself away again and again and again and again, time and time again. Make no mistake, our sins do pain his heart, and 70 times 7 is a lot of times to get your heart broken. And yet he opens up and allows us back in every single time. His love saw you when you hated him, and all logic said they'll reject me. He said, "Nah, I don't care what it costs me. I lay my life on the line as long as I get their hearts." To make it personal, his love saw me, a broken down kid with regret as deep as the ocean. My innocence and youth poured out like water. And he found me and he put me on his shoulders. And he carried me on. Because he's just that good. He's just that kind. He's a father that never gives up. So as we sing this bridge and chorus one more time, just let it break down those walls tonight. There's no shadow. There's no shadow you won't light up. Mountain you won't climb up. Coming after me. Yeah. There's no wall you won't kick down. Lie you won't tear down. Coming after me. Yeah, again. There's no shadow you won't light up. Mountain you won't climb up. Coming after me. He's breaking off self-hatred tonight. There's no wall you won't kick down. Lie you won't tear down. Coming after me. There's no shadow now. There's no shadow you won't light up. Mountain you won't. Come on, let it rise. There's no wall you won't kick down. Lie you won't. Come on. Declare it. No shadow now. There's no shadow you won't light up.
Wow. I just want to say that we're going to stay here.